Let's take our Bibles and turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 9. We'll be looking at the end of the chapter and through chapter 10. And I wanted to make a couple of comments. I hope I'm correct in the one. Separation of church and state is, we use words and we use them on purpose. It's not separation of an individual from state. Okay, we have to have individuals in government. And it's not separation of an individual from his religious beliefs. It's separation of the church, organization from the state. And that's, if we just look at what the words actually mean, it's a very simple, simple thing. There's not really much problem with saying we believe in separation of church and state because we don't want the church to be ruling us in a governmental way. You wouldn't want Pastor Dameron to the ideas that he has about government to be law. Nobody, we don't want that. He's a pastor. He's not the governor. Okay. Anyway, so that, and then, I think it's in that phrase, separation of church and state, the justices found that in Thomas Jefferson's writing. But I think it's curious. I believe I'm correct in saying that Thomas Jefferson really had nothing to do with our U.S. Constitution. Mr. Reinhardt, am I correct on that? Yeah. He was off in France or something being a diplomat. So his understanding of the Constitution itself is quite limited compared to a James Madison or the others that actually put our Constitution together. He was the primary writer of our Declaration of Independence, and lo and behold, it talks about a creator there, which atheists wouldn't really acknowledge very much. But let me just say also that people that get all up in arms about somebody who prays or acknowledges God at a public function, a public school function, which is a government function. Public schools are government entities. That's why it's a problem. We don't like to admit that until it's somebody prays or something like that. But let me just say, isn't if we do not pray, isn't that an expression of religious belief? It is. Everyone has a religion. So you cannot do anything without expressing your religious belief. So if you get up and do not pray, you are expressing a religious belief. You're espousing a religious belief. But those that are secularist claim that secularism is not a religious belief, and of course it is. That's why they're so antagonistic toward those who actually say that they are religious. Okay, enough of commenting on the comments or whatever. Let's see here. That's all my notes I scribbled there. We're going to get into Ecclesiastes, and we're nearing the end. We still have a few weeks left. We're going to draw it out as long as we can for Sam. It's funny, Dr. Swangam picks on Edgar, and I pick on Sam. We had a hard time the last week or so without having Sam here to pick on. But now we can get back to normal. Ecclesiastes, we're going to be looking at chapter 9 and beginning in verse 13. But as we've done each week, especially through the summer when we have more visitors, I'd like to set it in its context and point out some things so that you can at least be close to the same way of thinking as we are as a class coming through it. So the book of Ecclesiastes is a sermon. That's my contention. The very first words in the book say the words of the preacher. And I know preachers don't, it's not everything that a preacher says is a sermon. When I'm, sitting around the house with my wife, I'm not preaching to her most of the time. But if we're going to publish something that are the words of a preacher, it would be a sermon. So the words of the preacher here in Ecclesiastes is a sermon, but it's a different type of a sermon on two accounts. One is that it's got a lot of poetic expression in it, some actually in poetic verse, which we don't really see because it was written in Hebrew. So the rhyme and meter and all that kind of stuff doesn't come across to us in English. But it's written in poetic verse, but even the prose sections use a lot of poetic expression. So it's not as straightforward as the epistles of Paul or even the prophecies of the Old Testament prophets. And then the other thing that makes it a little bit different is that his approach is what we would say when we study rhetoric, speech, writing, whatever, is an inductive approach. A deduction says, makes a point and then gives supporting points. Induction goes backwards from that. It kind of just gives us different things along the way and brings us toward a conclusion. And so this is what this is the form of presentation in Ecclesiastes. He has a text, and then he talks about many different things, and he's going to come to a conclusion. Along the way, he has given some partial conclusions, but not complete, and we're not to the full conclusion even yet this week. But the text is chapter 1, verses 1 or 2 through 11, and to generalize, basically, the preacher looks at life around. He looks all around at everything that we can see here on earth, or the phrase that he uses, under the sun, and says that life here is meaningless. It seems meaningless. Things don't go the way they should. We look at something and we say, that's not right. And he doesn't say this, but if we think about it, of course it's not right. I mean, the only place it was right was the Garden of Eden. And something happened there that made everything just all fouled up. And so the preacher looks around and says, life doesn't go the way it should. And then he proceeds, really, through other things, that even when it does, let's put it this way, even when life does go the way we think it should, it still doesn't fulfill. There's still an emptiness there. We use the term empty. He uses the word vanity. Over and over. Vanity, emptiness, emptiness. Life is full of emptiness. Now, we won't say that every moment of every day is empty. There are things that give us partial fulfillment, but nothing completely fulfills. In the end, it's all empty. If down here, under the sun, life here is all that we look at. So that's his text, and then what he goes through is begins to take us through the areas of life, the facets of our living that mankind seeks for fulfillment in. It begins with the area of knowledge and wisdom. Some people give their life to that. I mean, we have people with PhDs and THDs and every other, you know, DDDs after their name. They learn, and yet there's always something to learn. Why? Because it's not fulfilling. There's still more out there. That even what you do find out, he tells us, the more we know, the more we find out that everyone else is unfulfilled too. No one has figured out how to be fulfilled with what is here on the earth. And so knowledge doesn't fulfill or satisfy. Pleasures, he addresses. There are things that do give pleasure. And many of them, in and of themselves, are not evil or wicked, but they also are not fulfilling. Whether it's, I always think of athletics, I guess I'm a guy, different types of sports things are enjoyable, yet whether it's participating in them or observing them, either way, the final whistle blows or whatever it is that ends the event, and then it's over. And it's, you know, it's can't wait till we can do that again, can't wait till we can watch that again, can't wait till we can participate in that. Why? Because it doesn't fulfill. It does give pleasure, but it doesn't fulfill. And whether it's food, I like food too. I like to go out to a nice restaurant. But you know, the next day, or even maybe if I eat too much, 2 or 3 days later, I'm hungry again and I want to eat again. Whatever it is, the things in life that give pleasure do give pleasure, but they don't fulfill. Business. People work. Some people are workaholics. And they get an intense pleasure. They get real enjoyment out of working, but not fulfillment. Just working doesn't fill, doesn't give total meaning to us. Some people like to be a part of public affairs, live a life that's somewhat public. Whether it is like me, I have a little bit of a public life. Right now, this is public in front of couple of hundred people, or government, public affairs. Some people think, you know, they get some fulfillment from living a public life, but even that doesn't fully satisfy. We can look at people I mentioned this even if just as a class of people when we went through this the first time. We say we will never forget, right? But how many of us have forgotten? We have holidays in place to help us not to forget. But most of the time on those holidays, we just enjoy pleasures, food and barbecue and whatever, and forget all about the whole reason we even have the holiday. So even public life doesn't, at the end, I mean, if you give your life to, we have to have history lessons to remind us about the great people of our own heritage. Otherwise, we wouldn't know a thing about them. And they were great people. There may be some people today that heard the name John Leland and thought, seems like I might have heard that name once before. And really, he's very, very, very influential in the life that we're living right now. Whether you know about Baptist history or not, his influence is tremendous in our day-to-day life. We don't even know that. So if John Leland was hoping for fulfillment out of the influence, the public influence that he had, he missed out, didn't he? Because we've forgotten him. So public affairs. Money. Of course, money answers everything, doesn't it? Actually going to see that phrase in today's section. But many times we look at, we're tempted. This is a strong human temptation or longing to think that if we just have more money, we'll be okay. You know, things are, I'm getting by, but if I had more money, then I'd be set. Well, you'd be set for how long? You know, we know we wouldn't be set forever. There'd be something else that we would decide we needed money for. We always will need more money. So money, even though we pursue it, it doesn't satisfy. It doesn't give meaning. Then, the last one that he kind of looked at was the idea of balance or moderation. He says, okay, so don't go hog wild after anything. Just live a life of moderation. You can't get it all, so don't try for it all and just be balanced, moderate. We use the term the golden mean, which was much more well-known in ancient times than it is now. But just don't go too far into anything. And that's not a bad way to look at life, but if that's the only way you look at life, then you end up with the wrong view of life. You end up saying, well, everybody does a little, some things wrong, so it's okay if I do some things wrong too, just so it's not too wrong, you know. No one can be perfect, so I shouldn't even try to be perfect. I shouldn't worry. If I mess up a little bit and I'm not as good as I could be, that's okay. No one's as good as, I mean, there's not a just man upon the earth that doesn't sin. Everybody sins a little bit. So that view of balance is not really, doesn't fulfill, doesn't answer the needs and the situation that we have. And the reason none of this answers, and Ecclesiastes tells us this, is that God has created mankind with the phrase that's in the scripture, is with the world in his heart. Well, what is the world as the idea of eternity? Eternity is within us. And so as long as we're looking at time, as long as we're looking at things here around us, giving ourselves to any of that, pursuing it, whether we're pursuing one thing or pursuing it all in a balanced manner, as long as we're under the sun, and that's where our pursuits are, it will not fulfill us, because God's created us for more than that, with a God-sized hole within us, is what people have said before. And only he can fill that hole. And nothing that we look at, even though there are things given to us by God that are not bad to partake in, if we exclude God from those things, they will not fulfill or give meaning to our life. Now, along the way, the preacher has given some partial conclusions. And by that, I mean, he's kind of hinted toward where he's going, but not given it in full. And basically, what we've learned along the way in different points in his sermon is that these things that people pursue after don't fulfill. So just do what you've been given to do. The place where you have been, where you've been placed by God, the time that you've been placed, don't sit around thinking, if only I lived in the old days, or if only things were, you know, I wish I could be in the future. No, you're right here. God's placed you right here. live for him right here. Don't wish for other things. If I only had this, or if I didn't have this, then I could. No, don't just be contentedly serving where you are. With what you've been given, where you've been placed, in the position that you are, do what you should. Somebody said, and somebody ascribed to Martin Luther this, and whether Martin Luther said it or not, it's a good thing to believe. Somebody said that, somebody asked Martin Luther, what would you do if you knew that the Lord was coming back tomorrow? He said, I would still plant the tree today. Well, why would you plant a tree if you knew the Lord was coming back tomorrow? Well, the reason he said that is because I'm just going to keep doing what I've been doing. Ecclesiastes should teach us not to be too concerned about all the other things and just live where we are. Live with joy in the Lord where we are with what he's given us to do. That's the general theme of it, and we'll get to that conclusion more clearly as we proceed in the next couple of weeks. So, but that's where we are. We've come up through all those areas, and last week we began to say that the preacher is getting close to the end of his sermon. And you know how the preacher says in conclusion, and there's still about 25 minutes left in his sermon. So he's kind of conclusion, but I'm going to say he's summarizing. We've gone through all of those things, and he began a summary. Last week we talked about how he summarized knowledge and pleasure. And this week I believe he's summarizing public affairs. And so I would like to read, I think we have time to read the text, and then point out some things here in it. So we'll look at Ecclesiastes chapter 9, beginning in verse 13. This wisdom have I seen also under the sun, and it seemed great unto me. There was a little city and a few men within it, and there came a great king against it and besieged it and built great bulwarks against it. Now there was found in it a poor wise man, and he by his wisdom delivered the city, yet no man remembered that same poor man. Then said I, wisdom is better than strength. Nevertheless, the poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are not heard. The words of wise men are heard in quiet more than the cry of him that ruleth among fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroyeth much good. Dead flies cause the ointment of the apothecary to send forth a stinking savor. So doth a little folly in him that is in reputation for wisdom and honor. A wise man's heart is at his right hand, but a fool's heart at his left. Yea, also, when he that is a fool walketh by the way, his wisdom faileth him, and he saith to every one that he is a fool. If the spirit of the ruler rise up against thee, leave not thy place, for yielding pacifieth great offenses. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, as an error which proceedeth from the ruler. Folly is set in great dignity, and the rich sit in low place. I have seen servants upon horses, and princes walking as servants upon the earth. He that diggeth a pit shall fall into it, and whoso breaketh a hedge, a serpent shall bite him. Whoso removeth stone shall be hurt therewith, and he that cleaveth wood shall be endangered thereby. If the iron be blunt, and he do not whet the edge, there must be put to more strength. But wisdom is profitable to direct. Surely the serpent will bite without enchantment, and a babbler is no better. The words of a wise man's mouth are gracious, but the lips of the fool will swallow up himself. The beginning of the words of his mouth is foolishness, and the end of his talk is mischievous madness. A fool also is full of words. A man cannot tell what shall be, and what shall be after him, who can tell him? The labor of the foolish wearieth every one of them, because he knoweth not how to go to the city. Woe to thee, O land, when thy child is a king, and thy princes eat in the morning. Blessed art thou, O land, when thy king is the son of nobles, and thy princes eat in due season for strength and not for drunkenness. By much slothfulness the building decayeth, and through idleness of the hands the house droppeth through. A feast is made for laughter, and wine maketh merry, but money answereth all things. Curse not the king, no, not in thy thought, and curse not the rich in thy bedchamber, for a bird of the air shall carry the voice, and that which hath wings shall tell the matter. So in this section of Ecclesiastes, I can see, and hopefully I'm not pulling it too crazily out, and I don't think I am, a common theme of government, rulers, public life. We see in even in the little man, the poor wise man in the little city, and the king, he delivers this city from this aggressive king. So there's rulership there. And throughout this, we're reminded again that life, even government, is not perfect. We don't live in Eden. So I would like to just quickly summarize these sections of this and draw out some points for us to understand and remember from it. First, in Ecclesiastes 9, 13 through 16, we see the little city that is saved from a great king by a poor wise man. And what do we find out? Okay, if we're going to look, we're summarizing, if we're going to look to be a, to get fulfillment from public affairs, here's this insignificant, poor wise man. He delivers a city from a great king. You'd think they'd build a statue of him and remember him. But what happens? No. There was, yet no man remembered the same poor man. See, in this case, nobody remembered him. Maybe, you know, when they delivered, when the great king finally left, they hoisted him up on their shoulders and carried him around the city. But the next week or the next year, 2 years from then, he's back to being a poor man and not taken care of because of, you know, and he should have been. No, they didn't remember him. Then he says, and this is kind of a generalization from this point. Then said I, wisdom is better than strength. That's true. I mean, we have this great strong king, and the poor wise man delivered the small city from this strong king. Nevertheless, the poor man's wisdom is despised. Now, not in this case. This is a generalization. Generally, we don't go looking for a wise person to lead us. We look for a strong person to lead us, a person that has power or influence, not necessarily wisdom. That's what happens here on earth. That's his general. Wisdom is better than strength. Nevertheless, even though it is, the poor man's wisdom is despised and his words are not heard. The words of wise men are heard in quiet more than the cry of him that ruleth among fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroyeth much good. So, generally, wise counsel is not acknowledged. We can see this true in our own lives, in our own culture. When wisdom is followed, good things happen, but a little folly can destroy a whole lot of work. Okay? See that last phrase? One sinner destroyeth much good. We could have the perfect government, but we have the wrong person get in charge of it, and a little bit of time by the wrong person can destroy lots and lots of time and work to make something better. And this is the truth that we see here. Then, chapter 10, verses 1 through 3. Dead flies cause the ointment of the apothecary to send forth a stinking savor. So doth a little folly him that is in reputation for wisdom and honor. So somebody who has reputation and honor can lose it quickly. Just a little folly can cause someone who has reputation and honor to lose that reputation and honor. It's, a wise man's heart is at his right hand, but a fool's heart is left. Yea, also, when he that is a fool walks by the way, his wisdom faileth him, and he saith to everyone that he is a fool. Now, there's a couple ways we could think through that last sentence. Both are true. One is that when the fool walks by the way, his actions show to everybody that he is a fool. Another way that this could be understood is that when the fool walks through life, he looks at everyone else and thinks that they are a fool. He says to everybody that they're a fool. I think probably both are true. Everyone else looks at the fool's actions and knows he's a fool, and he's going around telling all of us, of course, I'm not a fool, telling everyone else that they are fools. And have we ever seen this in government? Wouldn't we say that, you know, common man, common sense kind of, and yet we have these rulers that think that we're fools and they know how to do things, and yet we can see that what they're trying to do is not helping. Verses 4 through 7. If the spirit of the ruler rise up against thee, leave not thy place, for yielding pacifieth great offenses. I'm going to come back to that later. There's an evil which I've seen under the sun, as an error which proceedeth from the ruler. Folly is set in great dignity, and the rich sit in low place. I've seen servants upon horses, and princes walking as servants upon the earth. Now, if to understand this, we'd say a servant is somebody, we're supposed to be servants. Well, not in this context. We want the prince to be the one that's ruling. We don't want the servant, in this sense, servant is a derogatory term, let's put it this way, to be the one that's ruling. Because it's in contrast with folly. Do we want folly set in great dignity? No, but often it is all around us. Whether, not every instance of government is folly set in dignity, but it seems like more and more around us and in all different levels, whether it's national, state, local, whatever. How does a rich person get to be rich? By wise use and stewardship of what he has. So we would want that type of person to be set in great dignity, but he's not. He's in a low place. Many times we see in government the wrong people are ruling. Somehow they've got influence and power, and they really shouldn't be. They're foolish. They're full of folly, and those that really could do a good job are not the ones ruling us. That's what we see in verses 5 through 7 particularly. Then, in verses 8 through 15, I see the work of foolish rulers. We see rulers often, they want to do, they've got these schemes. They're going to do this, and isn't it true that most of the time, the most notable consequence of a government policy is the one that they didn't think of. It's not their intended consequences. We live with so many unintended consequences. We say, well, we're going to help the poor, and what happens? They remain poor. They become, dependent. So we see here so many things that he does, and something else that he doesn't want to happen happens. He that digs a pit shall fall into it. That's not why he digged the pit. Whoso breaketh a hedge, a serpent shall bite him. Whoso removeth stones shall be hurt therewith. He'll loosen up enough stones and then the whole wall will fall on him. He that cleaveth wood shall be endangered thereby. If the iron is blunt and he do not whet the edge, then must he put two more strength. But wisdom is profitable to direct. How many times does government do things in the most dull manner? I mean, if they would just sharpen the axe, it would work better. Surely the serpent will bite without enchantment, and a babbler is no better. The words of a wise man's mouth are gracious, but the lips of a fool will swallow up himself. The beginning of the words of his mouth is foolishness, and the end of his talk is mischievous madness. A fool also is full of words. A man cannot tell what shall be and what shall be after him. Who can tell him? The labor of the foolish wearieth every one of them, because he knoweth not how to go to the city. Now, the second section there, 11 through 15, kind of is referring to a fool, but I think it's connected in the idea of we end up with fools set in great dignity, and they go on and on. They talk and talk and talk about what they're going to do, and it doesn't happen the way they think it would. They don't even know, they work and work, and what they work for wearies all the rest of us because they're so dumb they don't even know how to get to the city. That's what that last phrase is, because he knoweth not how to go to the city. The idea is the city is the capital. It's the city that everybody knows how to get there, and this, it's common sense. Everybody should know how to do that, and yet rulers many times can't do what's obvious. The rest of us could do it, but not them. This is the picture that the preacher's showing us of public affairs, people that strive to live in public affairs, and what happens there. Then we see some of the attitudes of rulers, verses 16 through 19. Woe to thee, O land, when thy king is a child and thy princes eat in the morning. It's not necessarily saying that it's bad if thy king is a child in age. Typically, it would be bad. But we had a Josiah who came to the kingdom at a very young age. But he was a wise child. So the idea is, woe to thee when thy king acts like a child. What does a child typically do? They're self-indulgent. It just pleases them. They're irresponsible. They want to play and have pleasures. They haven't grown to the place where they'll take responsibility for what they should do. Have you ever had rulers that are that way? You know, that they come to office and all they think about is all the fun that they can have because they have this power. All the whatever it is. I mean, the current one is all the golf games that he can play. But other presidents and rulers have had other things that, if they're ruling like a child, they just think, oh, look at what I can do because I have this place. Woe to us. When the king is a child and the princes eat in the morning. The contrast with that is princes that eat when it's time to eat. Eat when the work has been done. Eat for strength, not just because we can eat. See, blessed art thou, O land, when thy king is the son of nobles. And thy princes eat in due season for strength and not for drunkenness. The one, childish, indulgent, says the government is for me. All of this structure in place is just so that I can have what I would like. The nobles, that says that I'm governing as a servant of others. I need to eat, yes, but I need to eat so I have strength to go on, not just because I'm a glutton. Verse 18, by much slothfulness the building decayeth, and through idleness of the hands the house droppeth through. Many times people that rule or have influence, they want to enjoy what's there without maintaining it. Slothfulness, by much slothfulness the house droppeth, the roof falls through. Maintenance is work, and it's not glamorous. Just going out and doing the little things that need to be done isn't glamorous. So a child or somebody that's indulgent, they're not going to do that. They want to do the big things. But the things that need to be done don't get done. A feast is made for laughter, and wine maketh merry, but money answereth all things. And from my understanding of this, this idea is that if there's ever a problem, if we can just get more money, that will take care of it. Money answereth all things. Okay? And doesn't it? Isn't that the way many government people, I mean, if we just need more money. Well, of course, we kind of wonder, where is that money coming from? Or we don't wonder. We know where it's coming from. But a government, a ruler that thinks, all I need is more money and I can answer all these questions, all these problems, where is he going to get the money from? It's from his people. So, verse 20 says, curse not the king, know not in thy thought, and curse not the rich in thy bedchamber. For a bird of the air shall carry the voice, and that which hath wings shall tell the matter. Now, we need to finish up, but I want to say, what do we do? I mean, we can look at this and say, wow, he's got it nailed. Government is crazy. But, of course, God instituted government way back in Genesis chapter 9. We have to have government. So what should we do? Well, should we give up? Should we say, well, not even going to be a part of it? Should we give up? No. He's in verse... Where was that? Anyway, it says, if the spirit of the ruler rise up against thee, leave not thy place. He doesn't say give up, just get out of the way. So we shouldn't give up. Should we give our life to it? Not necessarily. The Bible tells us in other places, some trust in horses, but we will remember the name of the Lord our God. It's the same conclusion all the way along. We shouldn't say, well, if I get into government and I give my life to public life, I can fix all this. No, you can't. Some people are called to that. Somebody has to do it. But not all of us. We should just serve God with joy in the place where we are. If he leads us into that area, we could do some. But we shouldn't think that we're going to be able to restore the Garden of Eden by what we're able to do there. It's not going to happen. I need to go, but I just want to say rulers' attitudes, and just to give an example on a close level, the president of the Porter County commissioners, I happened to be standing next to him on election day, and a sheriff's deputy's car was there, and the guy was getting in his car, and he just kind of made a cracked a joke like, oh, were you thinking you're going to take it? And he said, I can't take it. I own it. Does the commissioner or the county own all the resources of the county? Of course not. But there's a perfect example of what rulers begin to think. And no, he doesn't own it. He's childish. He's indulgent. He is exactly woe to us when our commissioner is a child. Our president of the Board of Commissioners is a child. Anyway, that's current public issue. But the answer to all this is not to get all up in arms and say, well, I'm just going to run for commissioner. God may call some of us, one of us, probably not, but one of us to run for commissioner. But just if we did, we shouldn't begin to think that we could solve all of the community's problems if we were the commissioner. That's not what Ecclesiastes teaches us, that that's not the case. But it doesn't teach us just to get out of the way and just yield when things that are wrong are going on. We should do what's right, fear God, stand for Him in the place where He has put us. And today's example is public affairs. Let's pray. Our Father, we thank You for Your Word. Thank You that we can understand it, that we have it, that You've given it to us. Help us, Lord, to strive to understand it and not just to be able to say that we know what it means. Lord, help us to take what You've told us and taught us and obey it and follow it in each aspect of our lives. Please bless our church and bless our preaching service.